Here we go with the reading of today's Boston Globe. It's Tuesday, the 17th of February, 2026, and with the Boston Globe today, we say hello to Liza and Peter.
Good morning, everyone, and happy Tuesday. This is Liza. I am going to read an article from the front page of today's Globe. Trump wields strong arm against media. As creator, critic, plaintiff, and regulator, he can shape, overwhelm market. When President Trump sat for an interview with CBS News last month, the White House issued a direct threat. It would sue the network if the conversation didn't air in its entirety. CBS has already settled a lawsuit with Trump over the editing of a 60 Minutes interview with Kamala Harris, a case many legal experts thought it could win, at the same time that CBS owner Paramount was trying to win regulatory approval for a merger. This time, CBS aired the interview with Trump in full. In Trump 2.0, he knows all the levers and he has in power, and so he's pulling them a lot more, said Austin Cantrell, who served as a White House assistant press secretary during Trump's first term and now works at the Chattanooga, Tennessee-based lobbying firm Bridge Public Affairs. Since returning to office, Trump has taken the executive branch's regulatory and enforcement powers over media organizations and their wealthy owners to new levels. Combined with his extreme attention to coverage of himself, Trump's position in media has taken on a novel form in his second presidency. He's the political leader of the nation, but he also styles himself as its senior media critic and top editor. He has gotten real results, even as critics warn that he is running an authoritarian playbook on the media. A lot of this stuff used to occur in the background, said Michael Sokolov, a University of Maine media historian and journalism professor, who warned last year about the danger of the commander-in-chief becoming the editor-in-chief. They're not hiding it. Some media organizations have fought against Trump's attacks and resisted editorial changes, such as the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, which Trump has sued for defamation. But he has been successful in creating a chilling environment, the full effect of which may be impossible to quantify. Trump has sued major newspapers and TV networks, defunded public media, and overseen a Justice Department that is arresting journalists, including former CNN anchor Don Lemon at a Minnesota protest. Meanwhile, he has also helped transform his administration into a major content producer itself. Since taking office, Trump and his administration have churned out artificial intelligence-generated content on social media and staged immigration raids to go viral online. Underlining Trump's aggressive push is a splintered media industry where podcasts, new digital sites, and social media platforms have allowed the president to amplify his message like never before. The effect of that shift is a traditional press that, under audience and financial strain, holds less power. The White House media strategy is simple. Be ruthlessly transparent and unyieldingly aggressive so the American people can judge for themselves, White House Director of Communications Steve Chung said in a statement. If people are concerned because we ask media outlets to run the president's interviews in full, without deceptive edits, they should do some serious soul-searching and reevaluate their priorities. Trump's influence over the press can be seen in how quickly the news cycle changes. Just this year, the top stories have rapidly shifted between the Trump administration's capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to Trump's desire to acquire Greenland to ICE's presence in Minneapolis to the Epstein files, among others. The tools that he uses to control attention, divert attention, redirect attention, all speak to the fact that attention is a finite resource that is even more valuable in an age of infinite information, said Nancy Gibbs, the former Time magazine editor who serves as director of the Harvard Kennedy School's Shorstein Center. In addition to the changes at CBS, the specter of Trump has hung over a recent overhaul at the Washington Post. Billionaire owner Jeff Bezos, who has business interests with the government through his roles at Amazon and Blue Origin, has remade the paper's opinion page to align more closely with Trump, critics say. While the paper has been losing readers before the changes to the opposition, the opinion section, the shift triggered a tidal wave of subscription cancellations, facing a sizable deficit. The Post laid off at least one-third of its newsroom earlier this month, which included eliminating its sports and book sections. Bezos' sickening efforts to curry favor with President Trump have left an especially ugly stain on their own, former Post and Globe editor Marty Baron said in a statement. This is a case study in near-instant self-inflicted brand destruction. The Trump administration's pressure on the press isn't limited to national newsrooms. Last year, the San Francisco-based KCBS-AM pulled back on political programming after Federal Communications Chair Brendan Carr opened an investigation into the station, the Associated Press reported. The inquiry came after KCBS reported that immigration agents were in San Jose. While there are many cases where the pressure campaign from Trump and his administration has succeeded, some incidents have prompted backlash from parties that normally have backed the president. When ABC suspended late-night talk host Jimmy Kimmel for criticizing Republicans after Charlie Kirk's killing, Carr threatened regulatory action against the broadcaster, and Trump later threatened legal action. The pressure and suspension brought criticism from some Republican lawmakers, including Texas Senator Ted Cruz, in a rare rebuke. That's the kind of thing that can also unite libertarians with progressives, with First Amendment purists, and we saw a real public pushback on that, Gibbs said. There are more recent signs that the strategy is alienating some Trump supporters. After ICE officers shot and killed two protesters in Minneapolis, condemnation of the shootings could be seen across Reddit pages and influences that really dive into politics, The Verge responded. Some New Englanders who voted for Trump have been unhappy with his second term so far. That includes Daryl White, 66, a Skowhegan, Maine resident, who previously spoke to the Globe for a series about how voters feel about Trump's tenure. Specifically, White has disagreed with the president's handling of the Epstein filings, the government's role in ousting Maduro from Venezuela, and the United States' aiding of Israel in the Gaza War. He's also concerned about free speech and censorship, and specifically criticized the decision to arrest Lemon. "It's just your right to speak your mind and to stretch the law to arrest Don Lemon. I don't like Don Lemon at all, but I'm certainly not for arresting somebody," White said. "What are we, a third world country?" Still, Trump is constantly pushing boundaries and trying to find what can appeal to his base and upset his detractors. Whether it's tariffs or nuclear diplomacy or social media use, President Trump is comfortable being different and doing things that make traditional media uncomfortable, Cantrell said. "I know he does things on purpose to make the establishment media types go crazy." Although the pressure on media organizations has been higher than ever, Sokolow pointed out that the institutions pushing back against Trump have been able to resist him. "Those who don't settle with him have been beating him," he said, specifically citing Harvard University, as well as the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. "Settling with Donald Trump never ends the conversation." That's right. Over to you, Pete.
Thank you, and good morning, everybody. From the front page of today's Boston Globe, gunfire erupts at Red Island Rink. 3 dead. Gunfire erupted during a high school hockey game on Monday, sending spectators and players screaming and fleeing for the exits at the Dennis M. Lynch Arena. 3 people, including the suspected shooter, were killed, and 3 others were critically injured, officials said. Pawtucket Mayor Don Grieben's office confirmed that the shooter was among the dead. Tina Gonsalves, the city's police chief, said the suspect, identified as 56-year-old Robert Dorgan, who also went by Roberta Esposito, died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. "The police were not involved in the suspect's death," said Gonsalves, "and there was no imminent threat to public safety." Chris Hunter, a spokesperson for the city of Pawtucket, described the shooting as a targeted family dispute. Gonsalves confirmed that a friend of the family was among those injured. Grebian said the city is in mourning after a terrible tragedy during what was meant to be a celebratory senior night hockey game. Mm-hmm. Our prayers go out to the victims, their families, and everyone impacted by this devastating incident, Grebian said in a statement, noting the investigation remains active and the city is working with law enforcement and the state attorney general's office. Pawtucket is a strong and resilient community, but tonight we are a city in mourning. Laisha Brotherton, 17, was walking by the ice rink when shots rang out around 2:30 p.m. We heard the shots and we ran, Brotherton said. The kids were running out. There was a girl screaming. She and her sister took refuge in a Boost mobile store. North Providence Mayor Charles Lombardi said the shooting involved a family from his city. He declined to comment further, citing the ongoing investigation. Gonsalves said the three victims were hospitalized, but declined to identify the victims. She would not say what kind of weapon was used. It's too early in the investigation to identify people because, obviously, we want to make sure their families are well aware of what's going on before we put it out to the public, Gonsalves said at a briefing Monday night. She said police had interviewed about 100 people, including people who were in the arena watching the hockey game, as well as players and others involved in the game. Gonsalves said no officer was stationed at rink, and typically teams do not hire police detail for games. A sports reporter at the Woonsocket Call and the Pawtucket Times reported on social media that a parent tried to disarm the shooter. Shared video captures the sounds of many shots fired, then an 11-second gap and a final shot. In another video obtained by the Globe, the shooter can be seen in the stands wearing a white winter hat and tan coat before pulling a handgun from the clothing and firing multiple times at people. Moments later, as panic spread, a man in a black jacket is seen rushing the shooter from behind and wrestling the suspect to the ground. Gonsalves told reporters that a good Samaritan stepped in and interjected in the scene. That's probably what led to a swift end of this tragic event, she said. The 2 p.m. hockey game was between the Coventry Johnston co-op team and a Blackstone Valley Schools co-op hockey team, which include players from St. Raphael Academy and Providence Country Day School and North Providence and North Smithfield Public Schools. In an email to families, Dan Garrity, principal of North Smithfield High School, wrote that all of his school students who were at the game, including players and fans, were accounted for and safe. The school made counseling available Monday to students, family, and community members, he wrote. This is heartbreaking to hear about. I know many in our community are feeling shaken by it, Garrity wrote. Joseph B. Goho, superintendent of North Providence Public Schools, wrote in an email to families that the shooting involved spectators at the game and happened around the start of the first period. Fortunately, all students involved in the game are safe, Goho wrote. At this point, all other information is preliminary and has not been confirmed officially, but it is important to inform everyone that our students and the students from the other communities who participate in the co-op hockey team are safe. All students from the Coventry boys hockey team were safe, said Coventry's Superintendent Don Cowart. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives said on social media Monday they were assisting local law enforcement agencies in Pawtucket. The FBI said there have been no requests for its assistance. Rhode Island Hospital received 4 patients from the shooting, 1 deceased and 3 others in critical condition, according to Kelly Brennan, a spokesperson for Brown University Health. Pawtucket State Representative Sherry Cruz was home when a resident in the nearby Centennial Towers high-rise called her and said they could see kids screaming and running from the skating rink. Cruz jumped in her car and was there in minutes, she told the Globe, just as young people were flooding out of the arena. People were crying, she said. She told the Globe she heard young people saying, "He was sitting behind me. He was right next to me." "Honestly, I've grown up here in Pawtucket, and I haven't seen anything like this before," she said. In a statement Monday evening, Governor Dan McKee said Rhode Island is grieving again, recalling the mass shooting at Brown University in December, where 2 students were killed and 9 others were wounded. As governor, a parent, and a former coach, my heart breaks for the victims, families, students, and everyone impacted by the devastating shooting at Lynch Arena in Pawtucket, McKee said in a statement. People at the rink ran after shots were fired, finding refuge inside the neighboring Walgreens pharmacy, according to WPRI-TV. The Dennis M. Lynch Arena is managed and operated by Edge Sports Group, according to the rink's official Facebook page. Officials with the sports group could not immediately be reached for comment. The arena is also home to the Johnson & Wales men's and women's ice hockey teams. A university spokesman said JWU leases space in the facility. They said a JWU coach was in their office at the time of the shooting and was not injured. State troopers and police officers from Providence, East Providence, Cranston, Central Falls, and Lincoln came to the aid of Pawtucket police. "It seemed like everyone was ready," Cruz said. Video from the Lynch Arena that was originally capturing the hockey game does not show the shooting, but more than a dozen loud bangs appear to be the shots fired. Following the loud noises, chaos ensued as hockey players raced across the ice for the exit, and spectators fled. Outside the rink Monday evening, the mood was somber as families, including players still wearing uniforms, returned to pick up their cars and gear. Some paused and talked quietly with officers against a backdrop of crime tape and flashing police lights that reflected off piles of snow. Grebian said the Blackstone Valley's visitor center on Main Street in Pawtucket will be open Tuesday from noon to 7 p.m., with grief counseling for families and people who were present at the shooting. City Councilor Marlena Martins Stachowiak, who represents District 6, where the rink is located, said she was heartbroken. "Pawtucket is strong. We are neighbors who look out for one another. We're thinking about the families impacted, not just from Pawtucket," she wrote in a text message. "Families should be able to gather at a hockey rink and feel nothing but pride and joy," Martins Stachowiak wrote. "No parent should ever have to think about their child's safety in a place meant for fun."
Terrible.
Good morning, and over to you, Liza.
Thank you, Pete. Okay, this next article is from the Nation section of today's Globe. With rollback, U.S. basically lacks clean air rules. Clean car rules. Probably clean air, too. Legal challenges expected and fight against emissions. The monumentous end to the federal government's legal authority to fight climate change makes it official. The United States will essentially have no laws on the books that enforce how efficient Americans' passenger cars and trucks should be. That's the practical result of the Trump administration's year-long parade of regulatory rollbacks, capped Thursday by its killing of the endangerment finding, the scientific determination that required the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate greenhouse gases because of the threat to human health. "The U.S. no longer has emission standards of any meaning," said Margot Ogg, who served as the EPA's top vehicle emissions regulator under 3 presidents and has since advised both automakers and environmental groups. "Nothing. Zero," she added. "Not many countries have zero." Transportation is the largest single source of greenhouse gases in the United States. Car buyers could still vote with their wallets, demanding more fuel-efficient cars. California has vowed to sue to maintain stricter standards. The Department of Transportation still regulates fuel economy under rules meant to conserve oil and the EPA still regulates other tailpipe emissions, like nitrogen oxides, that harm human health. But last year, the Trump administration proposed weakening the fuel economy standards to largely irrelevant levels. The Republican-controlled Congress also set civil penalties for violations at $0, essentially making them voluntary for automakers. In addition, Congress last year blocked California's clean car rules. The bottom line is that the United States is set to stand apart from a majority of the world's industrialized nations, which have mandatory fuel economy or greenhouse gas tailpipe emission rules. The Biden administration had sought to tighten limits on emissions to encourage automakers to sell more non-polluting electric vehicles. The Trump administration's elimination of the endangerment finding is expected to face fierce legal challenges from the environmental groups and others. The endangerment finding was a 2009 scientific conclusion that greenhouse gas emissions pose a danger to Americans' health and welfare. It provided the foundation to justify federal regulations that limit carbon dioxide, methane, and other pollution, including from cars. If the EPA's decision holds, it could increase the country's greenhouse gas emissions by 10% over the next 30 years, according to the Environmental Defense Fund, an advocacy group. Greenhouse emissions are the main driver of global climate change, which in turn is intensifying heat waves, drought, hurricanes, and floods, while also melting glaciers, causing sea levels to rise. Lee Zeldin, the EPA administrator, called the end of the finding the single largest deregulatory action in the history of the United States. He accused Democrats of having launched an ideological crusade on climate change that had struggled entire sectors of the United States economy, particularly the auto industry, which has struggled to sell electric vehicles. Excuse me. Climate concerns aside, it's unclear whether the U.S. auto industry will ultimately benefit from the elimination of emissions and fuel efficiency regulations. The move could leave American automakers even more dominated by gas-guzzling trucks and SUVs, experts said, as China and other nations continue to shift toward cleaner electric cars. That could leave them at a competitive disadvantage in coming years. Our automakers are not going to survive, Ogg predicted. John Bozzella, president of the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, which represents automakers in the United States, has declined to say whether he supports the end of the endangerment finding. Over to you, Pete.
Thanks, Liza. From the nation section of today's Globe, bless you, the seedy side of college fundraising. Academics were enticed by Epstein's cash. Their buildings can be architectural wonders. The discoveries made in their laboratories can be spellbinding and life-saving. But America's colleges and universities are chronically searching for money, a reality that brought academic leaders and researchers into both Jeffrey Epstein's orbit and his inbox. The schools had the prestige to lend him legitimacy. Epstein had the money to bankroll projects. It worked well for some, until it didn't. Epstein, who in 2019 died by suicide in the jail where he was being held on sex trafficking charges, gave money or simply dangled the prospect of it before people on a range of campuses, including Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Stanford University, Bard College, and Columbia University. Some schools have spent years trying to distance themselves from Epstein, donating his contributions and condemning his crimes. But recent documents released from the Justice Department have prompted new recriminations and regrets. Many academics whose names appear with the Epstein files say they turned to him only because of his money and the possibility that it could underwrite college budgets and research efforts, even if their exchanges came after Epstein pleaded guilty in 2008 to soliciting prostitution from a minor. As I have said for years, engaging with Jeffrey Epstein was in service of one agenda, which was fundraising for Bard, the college president, Leon Bolstein, said in a statement. Nicholas Christakis, a professor at Yale University, wrote in an email that he only met Epstein once in the context of fundraising for my lab. We never got any funding from him, he said, adding, like other academic scientists, I am responsible for the financial support of my lab. Antonio Damasio, a neuroscientist at the University of Southern California, said in an email that colleagues had told him about Epstein, saying that he was interested in science. When Epstein invited myself and my wife, who is also a well-known scientist, to have dinner at his New York home with other colleagues, we accepted and we both attended, said Damasio, who said he has never received any money from Epstein. Epstein's motives for connecting with college professors and presidents were not always clear. He gathered celebrity and power brokers into his network. A Harvard professor who benefited from the Epstein largesse once noted that the financier also collected scientists. Epstein rarely followed through with the multi-million-dollar contributions he suggested were on offer, but he drew people in and appeared attentive to academia's unending quest to pay its bills. Private philanthropy has long been an essential part of higher education's business model, and some college presidents say they are spending at least a quarter of their time fundraising. Much of the money that is collected goes towards endowment, although the most recent federal data shows American colleges and universities collectively have more than $927 billion across their endowments, many of those funds have severe restrictions, limiting how they may be used and leaving academia more financially squeezed than the headline figure suggests. That is one reason researchers jockey ferociously for grant money and other gifts. But reliance on private money, industry officials say, leaves schools vulnerable to soliciting or accepting contributions from sources that might be unsavory. Rarely do the overtures blow up as spectacularly as the ones involving Epstein have. Authorities have not accused any of the academics whose names have surfaced in the files of wrongdoing related to Epstein. Academia has been awash in speculation over Epstein's motives for floating possible donations. Botstein said in 2023 that Epstein enjoyed humiliating and dangling prospects and had absolutely strung me along. Others have wondered whether he luxuriated in conversations with some of the world's brightest minds. Many also believe that Epstein sought to leverage academia's reputation to clean up his own. For example, a Harvard professor whose program received millions from Epstein, greenlit proposals made by the financier's publicist to feature Epstein on a university website. In a report Harvard issued in 2020, the university said the requests appeared to be part of a larger effort to rehabilitate Epstein's image. The university also noticed that Epstein's foundation website overstated its gifts to Harvard by tens of millions of dollars. Having one of those universities as part of your philanthropic portfolio adds a tremendous amount of credibility, and I think that's what a university should be worried about. Is an unsavory character using me to whitewash a lifestyle? Said Nicholas S. Zepos, a former Vanderbilt University chancellor. Universities have long debated approaches to so-called tainted money. Some academic leaders have argued that it's better for the money to be spent by universities, where the public good can be advanced, than for it to remain with nefarious sources. It's a tough area for institutions, said Gene Temple, the founding dean emeritus of Indiana University's School of Philanthropy and a former president of the university's foundation. They're in search of money, and the old saw about tainted money is that there ain't taint enough of it. It was not always clear how much administrators knew about Epstein's contact with their schools. Most due diligence policies, industry officials said, are usually built around gift acceptance, not solicitation. And some notable exceptions, particularly Botstein and Larry Summers, who led Harvard, Epstein's contacts with academia happened at the lower ranks of universities, in part because his potential gifts, while large, were not usually enough to merit the attention of campus leaders. Even apart from Epstein's 2008 conviction, James M. Langley, president of a philanthropy consultancy, said the donor's limited giving record should have raised alarms. "One does want to be alert to all possibilities," said Langley, who had held top posts at Georgia Tech, Georgetown, and the University of California, San Diego. "But here's something you learn from fundraising, and that is, if it's too good to be true, it usually is." Langley said he never understood why professors engaged with Epstein. "All of a sudden, this person of means is coming to you, so in some ways that may reinforce your view that the larger system doesn't appreciate you as well as it should," said Langley, who said Epstein's apparent interest may have been seductive to researchers. Zeppos argued that the episode had exposed a vulnerability in the system. "Sometimes," he said, "those things are just like airline crash cases that could be prevented, a set of circumstances that should set off alerts to everybody, but the system just fails."
Everybody's
more insight into college education.
Yeah, everybody's making excuses. Okay. This next article is from the Nation section. Kansas locals stand by mayor charged with voting illegally. Defendant status as non-citizen is focus of complaint. Coldwater, Kansas. A standing room only crowd jammed recently into the only courtroom in Comanche County, Kansas. Residents came on their lunch breaks, trekked in from their ranches, and even closed down a hardware store so they could watch. They were there for a man at the defendant's table, Joe Ceballos, who just weeks before had been reelected mayor of Coldwater in a small town landslide with 101 votes to his opponent's 20. There had been no time to celebrate. Hours before the votes were tallied, Ceballos, a legal permanent resident of the United States, was charged in state court for voting illegally as a non-citizen. Now, Ceballos, 55, sat in the courtroom, glancing downward as a prosecutor from the Kansas Attorney General's office rattled off a list of felony charges that could lead to years in prison. 3 counts of election perjury, 3 counts of voting without being qualified. When the charges were announced a few weeks before the hearing, the municipal politics of Coldwater suddenly became national news. Many conservatives from outside Comanche County framed the case as an example of rampant voter fraud. Before the first court hearing in December, the Trump administration drew attention to the case, pledging to seek Ceballos' deportation if he were convicted. "This alien committed a felony by voting in American elections," Tricia McLaughlin, a spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security, said in a news release. Yet inside Coldwater, home to 700 people, the prosecution was widely seen as a personal attack on a pillar of the town. Most of them, Ceballos included, had voted for President Trump, and some said they supported his immigration policies. But they knew Joe, a fixture in Coldwater since he was a teenager, and they wanted the government to back off. Decades before he appeared at the county courthouse as a defendant, Ceballos said he went to the same limestone trim building on New York Ave on a high school field trip. His teacher, Gail Boiso, said she showed a group of seniors around, taking them to the spot where they would pay their taxes and introducing them to courthouse employees. When they got back to the county clerk's office, she and Ceballos each recalled the person working there asked if students who were at least 18 would like to register to vote. Ceballos said he filled out the form. Federal and state laws require that voters be U.S. citizens, and Kansans must check a box saying that they were citizens when they registered to vote. Nobody ever told me that I couldn't vote or register to vote, Sabalo said during a recent interview inside the city council chamber. And so, as a young man, yeah, I did it. I registered. The county clerk, Bree Earl, said her office had no record of Sabalo's registering to vote before 1999, when he would have been in his late 20s. Sabalo's lawyer, Jess Holm, said in an email that Joe is confident he was registered and had voted prior to the renewal or re-registration in 1999, but I'm having a hard time proving it. Sabalo's was born in Mexico and came to the United States when he was 4 years old, he and his lawyer said. He moved around as a child before ending up in Coldwater, just north of Oklahoma border in west central Kansas, as a teenager in the 80s. But for all but a few months since then, Comanche County has been his home. Sabalo's, who received a green card in 1990, said he had never been back to Mexico. As he made a life in Coldwater, where 90% of the residents are white, Sabalo's became a regular voter, always choosing Republicans. He worked for years in Coldwater's Public Works Department, then landed a job as a lineman with a utility company, where he is still employed. His neighbors elected him as a city council member, then as mayor, a position in which he focused on keeping up basic services while managing a tight budget. He said the job paid $500 a month. He resigned as mayor soon after the charges were announced. To the Kansas Attorney General, Chris Kobach, the case against Sabalo's was proof of what he had insisted for years. Non-citizen voting is a real problem, Kobach, a Republican, said at the news conference where he announced the case against the mayor. He said that too little has been done over the years to identify ineligible voters and remove them from the rolls. Every time a non-citizen votes, it effectively cancels out the vote of a U.S. citizen, Kobach said, adding, if a person who is not a U.S. citizen actually ends up on the ballot for an office, then a U.S. citizen lost the opportunity to obtain that office. Kobach declined through a spokesperson to be interviewed. Outside Coldwater, the push to prosecute Sabalo's won the Attorney General praise from fellow conservatives. But around Comanche County, where Kobach and Trump have overwhelmingly won elections, some question the decision. A lingering question is what justice might look like in this case. Should Sabalo's be convicted of felonies, as the Attorney General is seeking? Or, as so many in Coldwater have suggested, might there be some way to give him a slap on the wrist and move on? Zavala said that perhaps he should be ordered to pay a fine or even spend time on probation, but he feared a felony conviction would mean being sent back to a country he has not visited in half a century, away from his family and his cows and his tidy house on the edge of town. Over to you, Pete.
Thank you. And from today's Metro section, the streets of San Francisco, the Waymo Way. And this is by Stan Grossfeld of the Globe staff. My son Sam thought it was a fun idea to surprise his old man with a driverless taxi ride. Me? Not so much. We are going to die, I blurted out when told we would not be taking an Uber. Why are we trusting our lives to an AI and sensor computer-driven car? It is essentially a video game come to life. Traveling in an earthquake-prone city with gigantic hills while watching a driverless steering wheel spin back and forth is bizarre. It's like a scene from a bad horror movie. Paranoia sets in. What if the computer fails to stop at the top of one of San Francisco's oh-so-steep cable car hills? That could be worse than a Steve McQueen chase scene. Waymo says there are backups. There's a push button to help, but if you're trapped in the back seat, what can it do? Offer last rites? Great. God take me now. I have had plenty of excitement in this city by the bay. During the 1989 World Series, I photographed a guy clutching his kid as an earthquake rattled and shook Candlestick Park. They were scared, and I offered advice. A week later, he telephoned the Globe and swore at me. He had banged in sick, and his boss saw his picture on the front page of the Sacramento Bee. I also climbed up part of the span of the Oakland Bay Bridge for a story while clipped onto the safety cables for safety. Below me, the kind folks of the Bay Area rolled down their windows and offered unsolicited advice. "Jump, expletive," they yelled.
Yikes.
I digress. Since Waymo just announced it was coming to Boston for a test drive, we owed it to readers to give it a ride. Exactly on time, the all-electric, clean, white Jaguar I-Pace SUV pulls up with my Sam's initials on the top. He unlocks the car with his phone app. "The Waymo driver is in control at all times," it says on the steering wheel. Sitting in the driver's seat is Verboten. The car has a gigantic wedding cake tower of technology and whirring gizmos all around it. They include 29 cameras, 5 LIDARs, which are used for lighting, mapping, and sensing, and 6 radar trackers. So, we breathe deep, buckle up, and give it a go. They've already given 20 million rides with a 93% satisfaction rating, according to their website. They claim a 90% reduction in serious injury crashes compared to Homo sapien drivers. The back seat is comfy. There's no driver to hog the legroom, and, note to single women, you'll never get hit on by an empty seat. Once the seat belts are locked in, the steering wheel starts turning. Off we go. The ride is slow and smooth. There is no tailgating and no zigzagging. An initial serene feeling comes over us. Why? Maybe it's the soft spa music playing. There's a backseat touchscreen with choices of music and temperature controls. No Grateful Dead in San Francisco? Shameful. Safety is paramount, but the driverless car is also incredibly slow. "My God, this is slower than Grandma," says Sam. May she rest in peace. At the very first red light, the Waymo signals a left-hand turn. When the light changes, it just sits there. 16 seconds go by, or a lifetime, judging by the driver honking behind us, who behaves like a native masshole. Sam forgets he's now in Mellow, California. "Let's go, buddy," he yells. It's an expletive green light. To whom is he talking? In other situations, the Waymo is far too polite. There are opportunities to go, but Waymo says no. Anyhow, by now we're having a ball FaceTiming friends and family. In our short test run, this 1.16-mile journey with light traffic took 13 minutes and cost $15.06. Pricier than Uber, but not by much, considering there is no one to tip. Taxis and Uber drivers hate Waymo vehicles. They cause gridlock, and they take jobs away, they said. But this is no fad. Waymo just announced a $16 billion worldwide expansion to over 20 cities. But while they'll be testing vehicles in Boston, Massachusetts does not yet have a law regulating self-driving vehicles, though 2 bills are pending on Beacon Hill. Elsewhere, the Waymo invasion may not be smooth. San Francisco has shown some resistance since the vehicles arrived and started testing here in 2021. 3 years ago, a Waymo was torched during Lunar New Year celebrations in Chinatown. A mob smashed its windows and threw firecrackers inside, destroying the empty vehicle. A group called Safe Street Rebel would also deliberately step in front of a Waymo, make it stop, and then plant a traffic cone on the hood, rendering it inoperable. In 2025, KitKat, a beloved bodega cat, I've heard of this story, was run over by a Waymo, which did not recognize him under the vehicle, despite a woman crouching in front of the car just moments before. Austin will not welcome robotic drivers. Waymo just might be the worst thing to come to the hub from the Bay Area since the Red Sox signed an overweight panda, Pablo Sandoval, from the Giants in 2014. Boston has perennially been chosen as having the worst and riskiest drivers in the USA. In the hub, yellow means go, and red often means go faster. I can envision a Waymo clogging a rotary politely, waiting for a moment that just won't come. While Waymo can recognize some hand signals, other forms of communication like flashing headlights, a nod, a smile, or even a mingled middle finger salute might be over its computer brain. On the other hand, truth be told by these humans, the ride was a lot of fun. Over to you, Liza.
Thank you, Pete. Okay, this next article is from the Nation section. Georgia father called liable for providing weapon to son. A man whose teenage son is accused of killing two students and two teachers at a Georgia high school should be held responsible for providing the weapon despite warnings about alleged threats his son made, the prosecutor said Monday. The trial of Colin Gray began Monday in one of several cases around the country where prosecutors are trying to hold parents responsible after their children are accused in fatal shootings. Gray faces 29 counts, including two counts of second-degree murder, two counts of involuntary manslaughter, and numerous counts of second-degree cruelty to children related to the September 2024 shooting at Appalachia High School in Winder. This is not a case about holding parents accountable for what their children do, Barrow County District Attorney Brad Smith said in his opening statement. This case is about this defendant and his actions in allowing a child that he has custody over access to a firearm and ammunition after being warned that the child was going to harm others. Prosecutors argue that amounts to cruelty to children. And second-degree murder is defined in Georgia law as causing the death of a child by committing the crime of cruelty to children. Investigators have said Colt Gray, who was 14 at the time, carefully planned the September 4, 2024 shooting at the school northeast of Atlanta that is attended by 1,900 students. But Brian Hobbs, an attorney for Colin Gray, said the shooting's planning and timing were hidden by Colt Gray from his father. That's the difference between tragedy and criminal liability. You cannot hold someone criminally responsible for failing to predict what was intentionally hidden from them. With a semi-automatic rifle in his book bag, the barrel sticking out and wrapped in poster board, Colt Gray boarded the school bus, investigators said. He left his second period class and emerged from a bathroom with the gun and then shot people in a classroom and hallways, they said. Smith told the jury that Colin Gray's daughter was was in lockdown at her middle school and texted her father that there had been a shooting at the high school. When law enforcement arrived at Gray's home, he met them in the garage and without any prompting, he blurts out, "I knew it," Smith said. 16 months before the shooting, in May 2023, law enforcement acted on a tip from the FBI after a shooting threat was made online concerning an elementary school. The threat was traced to a computer at Gray's home. Colin Gray was told about the threat and was asked whether his son had access to guns. Gray replied that he and his son take this school shooting stuff very seriously, according to Smith. Colt Gray denied that he made the threat and said that his online account had been hacked, Smith said. That Christmas, Colin Gray gave his son the gun as a gift and continued to buy accessories after that, including a lot of ammunition, Smith said.
Over Unbelievable.
To you, Pete. I know. Over to you.
Thanks. From the Metro section of today, From the Metro section, plug-in solar could have a standout year in New England. The solar panels that hang from balconies across Europe may soon be coming to New England, helping lower energy costs and ease grid demand. This could be a breakout year for plug-in solar in the United States, with more than two dozen states considering legislation this session, including Maine, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island. The small-scale systems are seen as a way to expand access to renewable energy, particularly for renters and apartment dwellers, but first require legislative approval. For many of my neighbors, especially renters, solar panels can feel like they're meant for someone else, said State Senator Nicole Grohowski, a Democrat and sponsor of Maine's plug-in solar bill, LD 1730. It's about giving someone in a third-floor apartment the same chance to lower their electric bill as a homeowner with a south-facing roof. The small units typically range from 200 to 1,200 watts, roughly the power draw of a laptop charger up to a microwave, are prohibited in most, in the United States because they conflict with electrical codes and utility rules that assume electricity flows in one direction from the grid through a home's breaker panel and out to wall outlets. Plug-in solar reverses that flow, allowing panels equipped with small inverters, devices that convert the electricity produced by the panel into the type typically used in homes, to plug into a standard outlet and feed power back into the household's electrical system. Plug-in solar is typically allowed only if customers secure special agreements with their utility, a process that can involve added costs, paperwork, and delays. Those restrictions have also kept major retailers, such as Home Depot and Costco, from selling the units. Proposed legislation would remove those contract requirements and update electrical codes, lowering barriers and making plug-in solar easier for households to adopt. Utah became the first state to formally allow plug-in solar in 2025, offering an early U.S. example of how small-scale systems can work. In Europe, the technology is far more established. Plug-in solar is permitted in 25 of the European Union's 27 countries. In Germany alone, since approval in late 2024, more than 1 million units have been installed. A study from Germany found that plug-in solar systems can pay for themselves in as little as 2.5 years. For renters and households priced out of rooftop solar, plug-in units could offer a more accessible entry point to clean energy by producing renewable electricity at home. Advocates counted that costs could fall as adoption spreads. Some also raised concerns about sending electricity back into a home's wiring. And that's it for today. Thank you very much for listening. This is Pete and Liza. We're here every Tuesday reading the Boston Globe. And you should stop by and listen in whenever you have a chance. Thank you very much. Take care.